Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
1 year later, what have we learned about who ordered the brutal killing of Jamal Khashoggi?
They believe, with medium to high confidence, that the Saudi Crown Prince probably ordered the journalist's death.
I speak with the award-winning journalist Jonathan Rugman about his new book. Then
I said, you know, I'm not going to write any more books.
So you kind of quit.
I did quit. I said, I'm not doing any more books.
Patricia Cornwell joins me, one of the world's most successful writers, jumping back into the fray and outer space. And from Syria to Benghazi to Russian election interference, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice on Trump and unsolved problems left behind by President Obama.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has announced a major civil rights move this week. For the first time, it'll allow women to serve in the armed forces. It's the latest in a series of measures to empower women and reform the economy. And it's done by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But whether it's women driving, new tourist visas or IPOs, it's all somewhat overshadowed by the brutal killing of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul a year ago. Saudi officials deny that the Crown Prince had any involvement in the murder, but a new book by the award-winning journalist Jonathan Rugman offers the first truly comprehensive account of the methodical planning and brutal efficiency behind the massacre and the role played by MBS himself. His book is called The Killing in the Consulate, investigating the life and death of Jamal Khashoggi. Jonathan Rugman spoke to me about his exclusive access to those involved, how he got much more of that gruesome Turkish transcript of the murder, and how he's still haunted by the very last images of Khashoggi alive entering that Saudi consulate. Jonathan Rugman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So it's just over a year since Jamal Khashoggi was killed so brutally. You've worked for so many months to make, you know, a new reporting of the background to that killing of the consulate. What did you think needed, what spurred you to want to write the book?
Well, what happened was I was sent to Istanbul to cover Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance, and I stayed in the same hotel where many of the hit squad from Saudi Arabia stayed, because it's close to the consulate. That's why they stayed there. That's why I was staying there. And I went to bed that night, and I found it very hard to sleep because I had all these images going through my mind of the famous shot of him walking towards the door of the consulate at 1:14 p.m. on the 2nd of October, disappearing, never seen again. Images, too, of the hit squad arriving at the airport, all that CCTV footage which the Turkish authorities produced. What I was trying to do was to expand on the CIA's assessment, which you and I have never seen, but has been leaked to responsible.
And that specifically is that they believe...
They believe, with medium to high confidence, that the Saudi Crown Prince probably ordered the journalist's death. Now, all those caveats are very important because intelligence is never 100% certain. But it was enough caveated for President Trump to be able to say, famously, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. And I think that's where President Trump wanted things to stay. He wanted that wiggle room, that leeway, so that he didn't have to take this case any further with the Saudi authorities than he took it. And my job essentially was to look at all the evidence, to try and build the case, to try and work out what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. Was it an accident? Was the intention, in fact, to render him back to Saudi Arabia, to put him on a private jet and take him home, which on the surface of things seems more likely, given that we haven't seen a case like this before. When we've seen Saudis snatched, it's to take them back home. It's not to murder them. Or was this a deliberate killing?
So I'm going to ask you what your conclusion was. But first, I want to play for you the very latest from MBS, as he's known, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and who most believe did actually order this. Let's just play what he said to CBS News recently.
Did you order the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
بلا شك لا Absolutely not. This was a heinous crime. But I take full responsibility as a leader in Saudi Arabia, especially since it was committed by individuals working for the Saudi government.
What does that mean, that you take responsibility?
When a crime is committed against a Saudi citizen by officials working for the Saudi government, as a leader, I must take responsibility. This was a mistake, and I must take all actions to avoid such a thing in the future.
So it's further than he's gone before in sort of an attempt at a mea culpa, but it's still, I didn't do it, somebody else did it, rogue operations, a mistake. In all your reporting, do you think it could have been a mistake?
I think the problem with the mistake theory, the best explanation you can give is that there was an attempt to render him back to Saudi Arabia that went wrong because Jamal Khashoggi struggled, overwhelming force was used on a 60-year-old man, and he died, and it was an accident. But then you have to ask yourself, what was a forensic scientist by the name of Dr. Al-Tubaigi doing there if his skill was autopsy, dissecting bodies? He had boasted in the past of being able to dissect a body in 7 minutes. I mean, he was famous for being quick at what he did. And one other thing I discovered was a longer version of the transcripts of the Turkish surveillance inside the consulate than has been published elsewhere. And in those transcripts, you hear Dr. Tubaigi talking with the hit squad commander, and the hit squad commander says, will the body and the hips fit in the bag this way? And the doctor says in reply, no, Jamal's a tall man, it won't fit. And they have a discussion about what they're going to do with the body. Now, that discussion takes place about 14, 15 minutes before Jamal Khashoggi arrives, according to the Turks, if you believe what the Turks are saying.
Do you believe it? And do you think the Turks should release the tapes? Have you heard the tapes?
I haven't heard the tapes. They have made it very difficult for people to take notes of the tapes. They don't want people to write things down. They have allowed, I think, at most 45 minutes of the material to be heard by various intelligence agencies and others when they claim they recorded 7 hours.
And why do you think that is? I mean, everybody knows now. It's not because they don't want to give away their intelligence methods, because we all know that they had it bugged. So why will they not release them?
I think it is partly a matter of taste. These are the dying moments of a man who is being held against his will. I think they've also been playing this diplomatic game where they're putting pressure on the Saudis and have been to cooperate. They've been demanding justice, but they've never quite laid it at the door of the Saudi crown prince in the way that others have. And I think they don't want to go that far. They don't want to be accused of trying to create an internal coup in Saudi Arabia. But I do think that these transcripts are a pretty reliable guide to what happened. I think the question is, could they have moved the timescale around? Could the discussion, for example, about what to do with the body have happened after the murder rather than as it has been presented before the murder? And yes, you're right. Questions will be asked about why the Turks haven't released this stuff. And the question is, if there is ever an international trial of those accused of this murder, which seems pretty unlikely, will the Turkish intelligence authorities want those audio tapes released in court, given that it was surveillance? Probably not.
So let's actually just talk about accountability, because obviously his fiancée, who was waiting out there for several hours while all this was going on, has said in very emotional terms that there's no accountability is being had right now. Let's just play what she told me a few months ago.
I feel very much alone about this. I feel I have been deserted. A journalist has been murdered. There hasn't been a proper investigation. Everything is in suspense, starting with the United States. European countries, states, leaders have not put proper pressure. They have not taken any steps with a view to getting answers, real answers, to this horrendous crime.
So Hatice is absolutely, obviously heartbroken. She was inside while all of this was going on. I mean, does she have any hope that there will be a proper accountability ever?
She does have that hope. She's
a realistic hope?
I don't think it's a particularly realistic hope. I mean, you have to bear in mind that the UN Secretary General has not got behind his own UN rapporteur and called for an international inquiry. What we have seen is a trial in Riyadh behind closed doors with 11 men on trial, five of them accused of murder, none of the names released. And the diplomats who have access to the trial have been sworn to secrecy. So we don't know what they think either.
Well, interestingly, because Bruce Rydell, who, as you know, is a former CIA official, he's very, long-time experience in the Middle East, author of Kings and Presidents, Saudi Arabia and the United States since FDR. And he has also addressed this self-defense claim of Saudi Arabia that it was a rogue operation. He says, let's assume that it was a rogue operation. He, MBS, has all the rogues, and they know where the body is. He, MBS, lied straight-faced. So that does put paid to the idea that it was rogue, not to mention the fact that they came on a private plane, that 15 or so people had to be allowed into the consulate. You don't just allow 15 people if they're rogues, do you?
Well, that's right. And we've seen photographs of some of these men standing next to the Crown Prince in 10 Downing Street when the Crown Prince was visiting the British Prime Minister, in Texas when he was visiting the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. So, and the other bit of evidence that often gets glossed over, but which is, I think, is really, really important as a sign of state culpability, is the cleanup operation. It's one thing to say this was a rogue operation and it shouldn't have happened, but then you spend 2 weeks forensically cleaning the place within an inch of its life so that there is absolutely nothing left, so that by the time the Turks are allowed in, which is not till the middle of October, they can't find anything, and they can't find the body.
Can we get to why you think he was killed? Some people are now saying that, you know, this Western narrative that he was such an outspoken critic of the regime is not exactly accurate. He was very close to the regime for many, many years. But they're saying that he didn't actually criticize the state. He criticized MBS. And when he started criticizing MBS and his accumulation of power, that's when his trouble started.
I think that's right. I think this was a personal dispute, a personal falling out. I spoke to David Ignatius at the Washington Post, who was one of Jamal's friends, and he made the point that we don't really know when the decision to kill Jamal was taken. According to the leaks of the CIA assessment, the Crown Prince talked about using a, quotes, bullet against Jamal Khashoggi more than a year before he was killed, and in fact, before he started writing for the Washington Post. And I think that's a very important point to make. In other words, this is a grievance that goes back quite a long way. It is a feeling that a former insider has turned traitor, a feeling that he had gone rogue, if you like, that he had been ordered to keep quiet, but then he had refused to do that. And also, I think, a man who had had a second wind in life from the aftermath of the Arab Spring, a man who felt very strongly, sort of discovered almost a feeling that he had left behind in his youth, that there was a better way for the Arab world, and he couldn't stop talking about it. And that had implications, not just for Saudi Arabia, but for the whole Gulf. But, you know, this idea that Islamist political parties could take over and could operate in sort of a democratic system across the Middle East.
Bruce Rydell also says that, contrary to sort of, again, the narrative that the Saudis haven't paid a price, in fact, they are paying a price. And he says, Rydell, that actually Jamal's ghost does haunt the House of Saud, haunts the royal palace.
Well, I think it only goes so far, that argument. I mean, after all, Saudi Arabia is due to host the G20 summit next year. So I'm not sure they really are paying a price. And I think everything we know about the arms deals, over 40 British fighter jets, that there was a memorandum of understanding, President Trump talking about billions and billions of deals that he wants signed with the Saudi Crown Prince. So pragmatism has won the day over the death of a single journalist.
What would you say is the most significant discovery or realization that you've come to in this year of writing this book?
I would like to say that the most significant thing I've found is that I've got much fuller versions of the transcripts than have been published elsewhere, particularly a few days before the killing when the plot was being hatched. All the officials in Istanbul talking to the officials in Riyadh, working out what they were going to do. But actually, what I'm most pleased about is that I have joined the dots, that the death of one man has ricocheted all the way to the killing fields of Yemen, I think in a way which many of us don't quite understand, in the sense that, according to a UNDP report, 233,000 people will have been killed by the end of this year during the conflict in Yemen, which started in 2015. Now, it was Joseph Stalin who was supposed to have said that the death of one man is a tragedy and the death of millions is a statistic. And I think what Jamal Khashoggi has succeeded in doing is he has turned the statistic of Yemen into a very real concern, that we saw the US Congress passing resolutions trying to get American to end American involvement in the Yemen war, forcing President Trump to use his veto for only the second time of his presidency. And who'd have thought it? A man walks into a consulate in Istanbul and disappears. He pricks the conscience of lawmakers. He makes people in America think for the first time since September the 11th about whether the trade-offs in the relationship with Saudi Arabia are worth it. And that is an extraordinary thing for him to have done. And if you read his journalism, and I've read all his Washington Post pieces, they are extraordinarily powerful. They are saying all the right things. They are not criticizing Saudi Arabia. He considered himself a very loyal citizen. He just wanted his kingdom to reform. He wanted it to end its conflict in Yemen. And I think it came from the right place. And I think he paid for his life with it.
Jonathan Rugman, killing in the consulate. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We're going to turn next to a very timely new book. This one, a novel and a surefire new hit by the much-loved crime writer Patricia Cornwell. Cornwell is best known for her hugely successful series featuring the intrepid medical examiner Kay Scarpetta. But after writing 40 books in 3 decades with 29 New York Times bestsellers, the American author was ready to walk away from that lucrative career. Until inspiration for a whole new series, sparked by the idea of female James Bond, launched Cornwell out of the morgue and into space. After 2 years of typically arduous research, plumbing every corner of the highly secretive NASA facilities across the country, Cornwell is out with her first book of the new franchise, featuring aspiring astronaut and cyber investigator Captain Callie Chase. It is called Quantum, and when we spoke here in London, she shared with me her joy about finding a whole new story to tell. Patricia Cornwell, welcome to the program.
It's my great pleasure to be here with you.
You have this whole new franchise. Quantum is the title of your latest book, and it's about space. And it's a departure, obviously, from the subject matter of your previous books. But first and foremost, at this stage in your highly successful career, something like more than 100 million books sold in more than 120 countries around the world, you could be relaxing, taking in the royalties. Why again now? Why are you starting off again?
Well, I mean, it takes one to know one, because I think people like us, everywhere we go, there's a story to be told. And I think some of us were put here to be the ones who tell those stories, who put a face on something, like you when you go to all these far-flung places that I'd be scared to go to, and you put a face on it. If I go into space or I take you in the morgue or in the forensic labs, I'm putting a face on these things. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're here to do, because if we don't do this, who's going to do it? And if we don't have stories, we don't know who we were, we don't know who we are, and we don't know how to behave.
You are actually known for the incredible amount of research you do. I think you said it's also scary. I mean, this process was a bit scary for you.
Well, it's mind-withering, because I always tell people, never forget, I'm an English major. You know, I dropped science. I can't do math. I have no sense of direction, yet I'm a pilot. I'm scared of the water, but I'm a scuba diver. You do stuff because you have to learn these things. But it is mind-withering. These people are so freaking smart that work in these fields, and they're dealing with things that are very abstract. It's hard for us to comprehend that we live in a world where almost anything can allow you to be spied on, and furthermore, that you can remotely do catastrophic damage.
Talk to me about your protagonist, Callie. Tell me who she is, how you conjured her.
Callie Chase, Captain Chase, works at NASA Langley. Mm-hmm. She's in charge of cyber investigations for their police. But she's not a regular cop. I mean, she's a quantum scientist, a quantum physicist, mm-hmm. and a test pilot. She got into the cyber world and military police. But the thing with Callie and her twin sister is from the get-go. They have been raised by these NASA parents and this guy who ends up being the commander of Space Force. They've been groomed to sort of be the ultimate new kind of James Bond type thing. It's people who go into space, but it's militarized because it's going to be. We're already headed that way. And you're dealing with the unseen world of electromagnetic energy, radio waves, how satellite communications, stuff that may sound boring, but you think it doesn't affect you. Try getting up tomorrow morning with the GPS knocked out all over the world and see how things go for you.
Let me just play this soundbite. It's actually you basically in situ doing some of the research. We're going to just play this.
I'm wearing a diaper. You know, it's not bad. I'll make y'all look good. Don't you worry. It's easy to do anyway. Blown away by this.
This is a persona, right? I mean, not a persona. This is you. You are this action woman.
You know what I really am is I'm a journalist. You know, my first and best and most honest big job I ever had was when I was a reporter at the Charlotte Observer right out of college. And I remember one of my early general assignments. Someone was teaching juggling in the park. Big assignment, right? So I went out to do that. Well, I learned right off the bat, my method was always to try what someone else was doing. The guy's trying to show me how to juggle. And so it's just what I do. I try to go walk a mile in the other person's moccasins. And that's how I know what it looks like, smells like, feels like. You know from the stuff you do. Mm-hmm. You can Google the morgue. It's not the same as walking through one. Is that not right?
No, it's absolutely right. And I'm going to get to the morgue in a moment because that is also a particularly gory element of what you did in your previous franchise. But I wanted to ask you to read a passage from the latest book. Here is Captain Callie Chase. She's entering a crime scene. It's related to a series of mysterious events that have taken place in this NASA facility at Langley, Virginia, as you described.
I intend to gather all the data I can before walking in, no matter how curious I might be. I am curious, not just a little. But insanely, insatiably, even if I don't let on, don't give the slightest sign of the magnetic force pulling at my attention. It's hard to explain, but I'm tactile and sensuous with an exploratory drive that keeps me from taking another person's word for it, from sitting still and being complacent. I have to see something for myself. I have to look, hear, taste, touch, and that's the compulsion I'm feeling.
So, I mean, it's really a little bit autobiographical, given what we've just been talking about, your research methods. It's also a bit of a testimony on our times, right? One of your characters, Richard Melville, General Richard Melville, head of the U.S. Space Command, says, "Our adversaries want us blind, deaf, and dumb, and guided by lies."
That's right.
Obvious parallels to today.
There is nothing worse than to have a brain damage guidance system. I'd rather have, you want somebody to steer you into the ditch. And we've all had GPSs take us through a part of town that was dangerous, haven't we? So use your head, everybody, and start being discerning about what you believe, because it's so dangerous. Oh, and by the way, speaking of, we talk about the general. When I first started doing this research, where I was really working on quantum very hard, I went to Colorado Springs, and I met with at least half a dozen Air Force generals, including one who's in charge of Space Command now. And basically what they all said to me is, listen, the biggest favor you could do for us is have a hero who's a cyber ninja, because that's where it's all at. Mm. That's what we're worried about. It's the 12-year-old that can hack into your rocket or to the Pentagon. And so for, you know, all of this is all related because you're manipulating things that people don't know are being manipulated.
In the film promoting this new series, you have joked, "I've had enough of Earth, I quit."
Yeah.
Is that a joke?
Not really. Not really. I mean, so much of humor is really rooted in, kind of true. No, people don't know this, but I tell you, when the 24th Scarpetta book came out 3 years ago, and that was my 40th book. Now, not the first four didn't get published, but if you did the math from the age of 21 to the age I was 3 years ago, it would have been me doing a book every single year, in addition to everything else I've done. And the publishing world has changed dramatically. And I just thought, I don't know what to, I literally said that I don't know what to do with her anymore unless I put her on the moon. Scarpetta. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to write any more books.
So you kind of quit.
I did quit. I said, I'm not doing any more books. And so I started doing research for film and TV. And then I got asked the James Bond question. And so I came up with a film proposal, met with all kinds of people. But they said, you know, we love this, except it needs to be a book. And I said, no, Rats and Rats Fink, not again.
So did people know that you'd quit? I mean, was it public? Did you make an announcement that you'd quit writing?
No, no. I really thought I would do this for a movie. And when I gave the, I've not told anybody else this, but when I gave the treatment to Amazon Publishing, who had done my Ripper book recently, I said, listen, maybe you could turn this into a graphic novel, but I'm really trying to create a film franchise type thing. I always think very small, by the way. And so they all came back, we love this, but no, we want a book. And I said, see, this is my punishment. I did something really wrong when I was little somewhere.
Yeah, like what? No good deed goes unpunished. Take me back to your previous franchise, Scarpetta. I mean, it's not often that you have a female writer or character sort of reveling in this, you know, the morgues and the gore and the crime and all of that. How important was that for you?
You know, when I started out, and when I was a police reporter, there were no women doing anything, including many women cops. And so I had two brothers, grew up in a town with all boys. So I'd been immersed in a male sort of dominant world for a very long time. But it was, you know, there's a good and bad. The good part of it is I always got underestimated. Mm. I still do. And I kind of like that because then you don't expect too much. And that's probably a good thing in some cases. But I try to look at, I really, you know, in helicopter flying, I always say, don't land until you know what's under you. And so the more you can hover and look all around and just put a face on everything like you do with all your travels, you know, the more you might see things in a more balanced way.
But here you are, 100 million books, 120 countries. The only author that really comes close to you is J.K. Rowling.
Well, I think she outran me.
Do you think so?
By light years, as we'd say in NASA talk.
Okay, so you're pretty close. I asked her about, you know, what it was like to be underestimated, what it was like also to come up, you know, through the ranks, so to speak. And this was a little bit of a back and forth about her name and why she chose this particular name.
And J.K. Rowling?
Mm-hmm.
Why the initials?
Oh, because my publisher, who published Harry Potter, they said to me, we think this is a book that will appeal to boys and girls. And I said, oh, great. And they said, so could we use your initials? And because basically they were trying to disguise my
gender. So before we get to gender, I just would like to point out that I am really environmentally conscious. I'm still wearing the same jacket that I did to interview her.
Yeah,
what can I tell you?
Well, I was
no
hoping.
Fast fashion for me. Did you ever have to disguise your gender or feel that there was a pressure on you as a woman trying to get some of these, you know, I mean, incredible adventure stories, actually,
well,
written and published?
I had the same discussion with my publisher for Postmortem, what name to put on the book. And the only reason that we didn't, because there was a discussion of doing P.D. Cornwell. There were two problems with that. One was P.D. James.
Yep.
I would have been great to be confused with her at that time. But the bigger thing was my name was already on the Ruth Graham biography I'd done as Patricia D. Cornwell. And so then they said, well, could we get rid of the D so we could make the rest of your name a little? I mean, over time, they would drop letters to make names bigger, that kind of stuff. Right. But probably it would have been initials back then had I not already had my name on a book. And they thought maybe somebody from the Ruth Graham demographic would buy Postmortem. The answer is no. Never.
So let's talk about Ruth Graham. And it is sort of exceptional and unusual to know that you were taken under her wing, Ruth Graham, the wife of Reverend Billy Graham. And it led you along certain paths. I mean, she was obviously, and I think you became friends with then George Bush Sr., the president. What did she do for you? And what did that time and those politics mean to you and affect your writing or your education?
Well, what she did for me gave me something that never changes, even when politics and your own beliefs do, because I certainly don't think anything that I was taught to believe as a kid. But what I learned, what I got from Ruth is she gave me value for myself. Mm-hmm. She made me feel like I mattered, because at the age of 19, when I dropped out of school and I had an eating disorder and quite frankly was thinking very dark thoughts and I didn't believe I was ever going to amount to anything in life. And one day the phone rang and she was inviting me to lunch. And I'm like, seriously? She was like, that was like the queen back then. And she gave me a journal and said, I know you're talented and I want you to write. And I thought of all the people, she would pick me. And that made me think maybe there's something worth salvaging here. And that is what I took away from that. And the most important lesson, you talk about putting a face on something, is always pay attention to the life before you. If you touch even one life, you've changed the world. And we need to remember that, too. So that was the best thing I got out of Ruth.
Well, I mean, it launched. It's you. She gave you your professional.
Well, the last year of her life, last time I saw her in 2007, I said to her, you know, I've only done two nonfiction books. One is on you and the other's on Jack the Ripper. I said, how do you feel about that? She says, well, I think I drove you to murder anyway. But, you know, it is kind of an irony, isn't it?
It is.
But it's about telling a story.
Patricia Cornwell, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And next, we turn to a veteran of U.S. foreign policy. Susan Rice is a former national security advisor and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She served two Democratic presidents and helped shape American responses to some of the most challenging crises the country has faced abroad. As such, she's also had to endure history's harsh gaze into U.S. decisions amid the Rwandan genocide, the Arab Spring, and the Syrian civil war. And she recounts all the decisions making policy at the very highest levels and owns up to her role in the good and the bad in a new memoir, Tough Love, My Story of Things Worth Fighting For. And she sat down with our Walter Isaacson to reflect on her years of service.
Ambassador Rice, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Walter.
This startlingly honest book is called Tough Love. And having read it, I now realize where the tough love comes from. You know, your upbringing was both loving and really tough. Let's start by asking about your father. Tell me about him.
Well, my father, Emmett Rice, was born in segregated South Carolina in 1920. And he rose ultimately to be a governor of the Federal Reserve, appointed by President Carter. But his childhood and his upbringing was very difficult because not only he lost his father when he was 7 years old, and that sent their family into economic decline, but he was really steeped in the most insidious form of Southern bigotry and prejudice. When World War II broke out, he was drafted and ended up serving at Tuskegee with the famed Tuskegee Airmen. That experience of serving in a segregated Air Force and fighting for freedom for everybody but his own people was a very, very searing experience for him. And unlike many people, myself included, who look at the experience of the Tuskegee Airmen as African Americans with pride to say, look, you know, we finally showed the world what we could do, that we could fight and be as, you know, as talented and effective as any white person. My father's view was that that was basically BS, that we had nothing to prove, that his job, my job, our jobs as human beings were not to prove to white people that we were as good as them.
That he gave you a bunch of lessons. He wrote them down even.
He gave us,
yeah, tell me.
He gave us tons of lessons. And one of them about race was, and this came later in his career, after he got his PhD in economics and after he rose to some measure of professional success, he concluded that if race is going to cause a problem, it's not going to be for me. Let it be for somebody else. And his ultimate mantra was, don't take crap off of anybody. Meaning that be you, you do your best, believe in yourself, and don't let anybody tell you you can't or stand in your way. And, you know, I'm
hey, that's
better
a theme
or for
in
worse,
this book. It's like you're not taking crap from anybody.
I took that message to heart, for better or for worse.
And your mother, Lois.
My mother
Wright,
was extraordinary, too.
Yeah.
She came from a family that immigrated to Maine, Portland, Maine, from Jamaica in 1912. My grandparents on my mom's side had virtually no formal education. One was a janitor. One was a maid and a seamstress. And they came to this country just like so many other immigrants in search of economic opportunity and education for their kids. They had five kids. My mother was the youngest. My mother was the valedictorian of her high school class in Portland, Maine. She was student government president. She was a champion debater. She just knocked the lights out. And she got admitted to Radcliffe. But because my grandfather, who was working as a janitor in a music store, had a catastrophic accident about 18 months before my mom was to go to college, he broke his back, shattered his feet, and spent months in the hospital so that all of their savings were drained. And my mom applied for a scholarship from the committee of the state of Maine that's supposed to provide scholarships to kids going to Radcliffe. And my mom was a shoo-in because she'd been valedictorian of Portland High School. And she was denied that scholarship because the lady who ran the committee told her that the purpose of the scholarship is after you graduate to come back to Maine and move in the proper social circles so you can support the college and raise money for it. And because you're black, you won't be able to do that. And so the end of the story is her principal in high school and her debate coach went directly to Radcliffe and asked them to give her the money, and they did. And so my mother made her life's work before she went into the private sector, expanding opportunity for low-income people in this country to be able to attend college.
And that's why, in some ways, she helps push the Pell Grant,
yeah.
Right?
Well, when she died, you know, her obituary said, mother of the Pell Grant, because she had worked for many years, along with Senator Claiborne Pell, to make that grant program accessible. And, Walter, I can't tell you how proud I am. 80 million Americans have been able to go to college because of that Pell Grant program.
How did you first meet President Obama?
I first met him in the summer of 2004 when he was running for Senate from Illinois. And I was working for Senator John Kerry, who was running for president. And I was one of the senior people on John Kerry's foreign policy team during the campaign.
When he runs for president, he asks you to join the team. But so does the Clinton campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign. Were you torn between the two, or was it clear in your mind that Obama was something fresh for America?
I had already committed to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized in committing to Obama, having been having served for 8 years in the Clinton mm-hmm. administration, that I was probably making a choice that was, in all likelihood, not going to be beneficial for my career, because most people assumed that as the betting money was on Senator Clinton to be the nominee, Barack Obama seemed to many people like a long shot, and yet I made this choice very witting of that potential consequence, because to me, Obama represented something that went far beyond politics or even political affiliation.
What's that?
Most of all, I thought that his election, if it could be accomplished, could be transformative and would speak volumes about our nation and its potential to grow and change.
So when Obama gets elected, he asks you to become the ambassador to the United Nations and asks Hillary Clinton, who you didn't work on her campaign, to be Secretary of State. And yet you form a pretty good bond with Secretary Clinton at that point.
She is, as you know, a pure professional. And we were there working in service of our country and in service of the administration. And I have to say, never once did I feel that she did anything other than provide me with the support that any teammate would provide to another.
That whole thing leads to the toughest time in your career, which is Benghazi. And what happened? You lost a close friend in the Benghazi attack. Colleague.
Well, Ambassador Chris Stevens and then three other Americans as
right.
well.
And it was not something you were particularly involved in. But then on a Sunday, they want you to do the talk shows. They give you the talking points about what happened in Benghazi. What does your mother say when you tell her you're going to go on the TV shows?
The moral of the story, Walter, is listen to your mother.
All right.
I went to check on my mom, and she's like, you know, I know you've had a rough week. Are you hanging in there? Yeah. You know, what is your plan for the weekend? And I said, well, on Sunday, I've been asked to go on all five Sunday shows to talk about what happened this week, which was not only Benghazi and that tragedy, but you may remember that many of our embassies around the world had been attacked by violent protesters, not terrorists, but violent protesters. So I explained to her that I was going on the shows, and she said, what? Why you? Why not Secretary Clinton? And I said, well, My understanding from the White House is she was asked, and she declined, I presume because she was exhausted after a long week and emotionally drained, didn't want to do it. And, you know, I didn't want to do it, but I agreed to do it because they asked me to. And I understand that somebody needs to go out on these shows. And, you know, I agreed to do it because I'm a, you know, team player. And my mom said, I smell a rat. You should not go on those shows.
Did she smell a rat, meaning that Secretary Clinton was setting you up?
I think she smelled various rats. First one was the one that I put greatest stock in retrospect, which is that, you know, in a politically charged environment, this is the middle of the 2012 election campaign, and something tragic like this happens, and inevitably, you know, the information is going to turn out to be in some way, shape, or form imperfect, that whoever's out there speaking first is likely to be targeted, not just the message, but the messenger. I think she intuitively understood that. I think she suspected that somehow I was being, you know, thrust forward by Secretary Clinton and she was receding. That I don't actually believe that. Mm-hmm. My mother and I have had this argument because it was, first of all, it was the White House that asked me to do it. It's the White House who goes and asks principals if they'll appear on shows. And I think Secretary Clinton may have just made a judgment in her own interest for whatever reason that she didn't want to do it. She didn't then say, but go get Susan to do it. At least I have no reason to believe that. So I never felt like the version of this story, which was, you know, that some people claim that I was set up, is fair. But what I do think is interesting, and what I've tried to learn as one of my lessons subsequently, is that my instinct to be a team player, to put mission first and not think about could there be some consequences for me, may be noble, but it can be self-defeating. And in this case, it proved to be costly.
So they gave you talking points, the intelligence community, that says, here's what happened in Benghazi. If I remember correctly, the talking points say that there were demonstrations throughout the Middle East, and it was opportunistic that then some extremists get involved and attack. And that's what you say. You follow the talking points.
Yeah.
First of all, the president. And then, boom, what happens?
It was some days later when information began to surface that ran counter in certain respects to the information in those talking points, which I said at the time when I went on the shows, look, this is our best current information. It could change. There are going to be investigations by the FBI and others. So I'm telling you today what we believe to be the case. But all those caveats got, you know,
so
dismissed.
You put the gun in a punching bag. I mean, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, all of them turn you into a punching bag saying that you were purposely misleading the American people, that Benghazi was a terrorist attack, and the Obama administration is trying to cover that up.
That was their line of attack against me.
Why did that happen?
Well, I mean, I think that's a question for them. I mean, my assumption at the time was, which also may have turned out to be false, that this was, you know, principally motivated by election year politics. And here was an attack against one of our facilities that killed four Americans on our watch, and they wanted to use that to attack the president. I think because I was perceived as being close to the president, because I was speaking on behalf of the administration, and maybe for a variety of other reasons, they thought me an attractive target.
Was there something you should have done differently when you had those talking points?
No, I don't think there's anything I could have done differently. What I did do and should have done was to compare those talking points, this is publicly provided, publicly available information, with what I knew to be the classified information.
And what is the classified information?
The classified information tracked the talking points. Mm. If they hadn't, I would have raised a red flag and said, wait a minute, why is there a disconnect?
So Lindsey Graham in particular becomes a point person. You become a punching bag. What's the phrase you use in the book?
Recyclable boogeyman.
Right. That's a pretty good phrase. But you're really tough on him. I think you call him unctuous, snarky, other things. Was this personal?
I had no relationship with Lindsey Graham until he went on television and called me either incompetent or untrustworthy. And, you know, I think America has now seen a lot more of Lindsey Graham.
What do you mean by that?
I'm about to tell you. in recent months and in the Trump era than I think they understood before. You know, I think Lindsey Graham had a reputation for being a maverick akin to John McCain, who I think genuinely was a maverick and somebody that I respect. I think Lindsey Graham was seen as somebody who, as he did during the 2016 campaign, told the American people how much trouble the United States would be in if they elected Donald Trump. And now, every day, we see him apologizing for, you know, whitewashing, sanitizing some of Trump's most concerning behaviors and decisions, as if, you know, as if he were on Trump's paid staff rather than a senator in the United States Congress.
During that period, President Obama was considering tapping you to be Secretary of State. And at a certain point, you decide you just have to withdraw from consideration. Tell me the effect that had on your son, Jake.
Jake, at that point, was 15. And all through the Benghazi thing, he'd been quite stoical, like, you know, not reacting the way his sister was, not particularly emotional about it. And I sat him down. I said, Jake, you know, I've thought long and hard about this, and I've decided to take my name out of consideration for Secretary of State. And he shocked me by bursting into tears and saying, Mommy, you can't quit. You can't quit. You've taught me all your life, all my life, never to be a quitter. How can you do this? And I was, I didn't expect that. I didn't know how to react to that. And I held him, and I said, Jake, I know I've taught you never to be a quitter, and I'm not quitting. I'm making a decision that's for the family, that's for the country, that's for the president's agenda. And he's like, he's arguing with me. He's like, the family's going to be okay. We've been through the worst. I said, Jake, sometimes it's not about you. You got to put a larger interest ahead of yourself. And I made this decision, honey, and I'm confident in it. I love that he loved me so much that it mattered that much to him. But I hope now that he's, you know, 7 years older, that he understands the logic of that better.
He went to Stanford in your footsteps, but he's become a conservative activist. What's that like dealing with that in your family?
It's interesting. I mean, there are lots of issues we disagree on. There are some things we agree on and we can find common ground, but we have robust arguments. But I love my kids more than anything. And Jake and his differing political perspectives have taught me something really important, which is that, you know, first of all, beyond any policy or political differences, we're a family. We love each other. We're not willing to let these things tear us apart, which doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean we don't argue on occasion. But at the end of the day, we are committed to hanging together as a family.
Is that a metaphor for our country?
I think it is. And I try to explain, you can't understand somebody that you don't see. You can't know somebody that you won't listen to. And increasingly in this country, we sort of live in our own little cocoons. My son, Jake, brings home to me on a regular basis an understanding and a perspective of how many people in this country think.
When, as National Security Advisor, did you learn about Russian interference in the 2016 elections?
Early August of 2016.
Should you have said something much more loudly as an administration?
I think we said something loudly on October 7th when the Director of National Intelligence and the Homeland Security Secretary issued an unprecedented statement, which said very plainly to the American people, Russian government at the highest levels is actively involved in trying to interfere in our elections. But what people don't remember, and the reason why the perception is that we didn't say something clearly enough or forcefully enough, is that within a couple hours after the United States administration issued that statement, the Access Hollywood tape was released, the one with President Trump talking about grabbing him by the you-know-what. That overwhelmed the news cycle. And then a few hours after that, WikiLeaks dumped John Podesta's emails. And so what should have been front page, top of the news hour, blaring news about Russian interference became the third story of the day.
But still, was there more you should have done, more you should have said during that period of October and early November about Russian interference in the election?
Well, my judgment is that we were right to put out the statement we did and to reiterate it as we did in public. We were right to focus on trying to secure or trying to help the states secure their electoral system so they couldn't be manipulated. We had prepared punitive options to use if we thought that before the election that would be useful. Where I think we made a mistake, or it with the benefit of hindsight, I wish we'd done something differently, was in two respects. One was when we ultimately employed very tough sanctions in December against Russia, penalizing them for what they did, we did not go quite as far as we could have. We didn't take the kinds of punitive measures that would have cut off whole sectors of the Russian economy, because we thought that that would boomerang back on our European allies. The nature of the tools we had were not discriminate. And because we were also trying to keep the Europeans on board with the sanctions that we had collectively imposed regarding Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And also, to complicate things, we had a president-elect who was already indicating that he was going to take a different approach to Russia and that he was much more forgiving of this interference. And so we were looking out over the horizon 3, 4, 5 weeks and wondering if we put the toughest possible sanctions on, would he turn around, you know, 2 days after the inauguration and undo them?
One of the most astonishing scenes in the book is this meeting at the very end when Obama is about to leave office, Trump is about to come in, where Obama asks, what should we be able to share with the incoming Trump administration?
Are there any limitations on what we should share? Because, frankly, his instruction, the president's instruction to us from way back was be as forthcoming as you possibly can. Because President Obama believed critically in the importance of one administration, regardless of party, you know, doing a smooth handoff, just as President George W. Bush had done for him, which he was always grateful for. But on the particular issue of Russia, given some of President Trump's public statements, given some of National Security Advisor designate Flynn's statements and actions, and given stuff that that we were seeing in other channels, there was a question in his mind about whether there was any reason we should be careful about the extent to which we communicate our understanding of what's up with Russia.
And did you hold back on communicating?
I'm not going to go there. I don't want to get into classified information.
When you look at the allegations against President Trump of trying to use Ukraine and now even China, calling on them to do investigations of Biden, from a national security perspective, how dangerous do you think that is?
It's extremely dangerous. In the case of Ukraine, it was, you know, withholding a presidential meeting and withholding military assistance, $400 million in military assistance, to a country that is occupied by Russia, that is in a hot shooting war as we speak with Russia, our adversary, in order to get alleged dirt on his political opponent. That's mind-boggling enough. China, the same thing. Make up some dirt on Biden and give it to me. And he says that right after he explains that he has all this leverage to use in the trade war with China. The clear implication of that for Beijing is if you make up some dirt on Biden and, you know, manufacture some falsehoods and give it to me, maybe some of our problems in the trade sphere or the security sphere or with respect to Huawei can be resolved in a fashion that you'll be satisfied with, Beijing. Walter, what that means is the president of the United States is selling out our farmers, our manufacturers, all of the American people who've paid mightily for Trump's trade war in order to get dirt on his political opponent. If that's not a corruption of national security and a danger and an abuse of office, honest to God, I don't know what is.
What is the overall effect on America's status in the world?
We have a president of the United States who's plainly and clearly acting only in his personal political interest. Who's going to want to join us the next time we call? Whether it's to deal with an Ebola epidemic, or to sanction the Russians over Ukraine, or even, as we recently saw, to join us in patrolling in the Persian Gulf because we're worried about Iran. The people aren't answering the call. And I don't know if I'm prepared to say that the damage is irreparable, but I think if we have to endure, and the world has to endure, frankly, another 5.5 years of this, it probably will be.
Ambassador Rice, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
And that's it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.